I was trying to think of the last time that we saw each other. I think if memory serves, didn't we meet like somewhere near Dulles Airport? And like I can't remember where that was, but we sat somewhere and had like lunch or something.
Yeah, and Chrissy was with you.
Is that
And it
right?
was big. Yeah, and it was so it was 2003, I think.
Wow. Yeah, so that was probably the year my son was
So
born, I think.
Thor, yeah, because I gave you a hat. That was where I gave you
Right. That's
the
right. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, he's such a young man now. It's amazing.
That's crazy. Yeah. He's like
Yeah.
t he's 6 feet tall, I guess. So he's taller than me by a couple
Where does
inches.
this, where does that come from?
I don't know, the cable guy, the milkman. I'm not sure. Something like that.
The basketball player that Chrissy was into.
Yeah, you know. So, how have you been?
Awesome. Good. I had a very robust theater life until about 5 months ago.
Oh yeah, don't tell me about that yet, though. I'm going to ask you about that because I definitely
Oh,
have
okay.
I've also cyber stalked you and seen what you've been up to over the years too. But yeah.
So, all right, yeah, so that's, but, and this is something you might want to talk about too. So last year I started a company, because Delia Gossman and a woman named Alexandra Arnari and I decided we had all this material, that we would like to pitch to streaming services. And, so we started a company, and it's a lot, it's a much longer story than that I'm hoping to write a memoir about. But, the upshot of it is, so I've been working on developing content, and I've talked to Netflix, and I've got my fingers in a couple of pies, and
Cool.
yeah, so I, it's something I can absolutely do right here at this desk.
Most excellent indeed. Where are you? What's your, I can't remember where do you live in the,
San Rafael,
oh,
California.
not far from where we once used to goof off and cause trouble.
You'll dig this. I have an office at 3210.
Really?
I pay rent.
Where?
I needed a place to sit and write that where the UPS guy wasn't arriving and the dogs weren't barking and Dave doesn't pop in like he just did.
Where's your office in the compound?
It's in the basement, not the basement, but it's C building, which is what that's the building that they occupy now. And they have the stage, and then they have a little section of D building, but I'm in C on on that very first floor in the back. So if you were to go down the second floor stairs towards the pit and turn left past the bathroom and the shower, I'm in that little hallway.
It's so funny.
I know when Greg showed it to me, I said, this is perfect. I can come in and out that back door. Nobody, like almost no one knows I'm there ever.
That's too
It's great.
funny.
Yeah. So that's where I get a lot of writing done, or I used to anyway. I've been there, I don't know, 3 times since March 16th.
Cool. Well,
Yeah.
so this will be a little bit maybe a little bit strange in that, like, you're the very first person that I wanted to talk to. I had this idea for doing like a little show, something like this. I've had a lot of interesting work experiences throughout my own career, and I've been working at this university, working as a professor teaching young undergraduate students now for the better part of the last 14 years.
I know I've written 2 letters for you.
Yeah, that's right.
I
Yeah, and one of the things that I've found a lot in academia, just personally, I've never worked in a place that works that moves at such a glacial pace as the academy. But the other thing
Yeah.
too, I think that's really interesting is a lot of my students are first generation kids to go to school in their
Wow.
family. And one of the things that I know I found really powerful when I was a student, and I think a lot of my kids find to be really profound, is just hearing from people who about their own journeys, to sort of getting to do maybe the things that they wanted to do, or even the sort of circuitous pathways that they've followed that have led them to maybe other avenues that they weren't really expecting. And so when I came up with this idea of like trying to see if I could talk to some of my old coworkers, when I look back over my own journey, I think about the time that I spent, I think about 7 or 8 years working at ILM right out of college. And I look back at the time, I don't know that I appreciated it so much, but I look back on that time and think that those were some incredibly formative years for sure for me. But also I met some incredibly amazing people. And you, Kim Bromley, are one of the people that I met during my time there who, whether you know it or not, had a really profound impact on my life. And so one of the things I wanted to do was get a chance maybe to talk to you in a way that I haven't really before about some of your background and some of your history. And that brings us to this conversation.
All right.
So, Kim, where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in Osaka, Japan, because my father was in the military. And then when I was two, we moved back to the States. So I grew up in Vienna, Virginia. He was assigned to a post in Washington, D.C. And they ended up buying a house, which was, so I didn't ever really spend a lot of time on a military base that I remember, but I had a sort of military, although my dad really wasn't very military. He was pretty laid back in that way. So I lived in Vienna, Virginia, almost my entire growing up years. But one year we went to Europe. We lived in Germany for a year. So I had the great benefit of traveling, but growing up in the same hometown. We actually went back, lived in the same house. So it was really a unique military experience.
So there was your dad and your mother, right? And did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have one sister. She and I are half siblings. We share the same father, and she's 7 years older than I am. So it was like I had three parents, essentially.
Well, that's really cool. So, and did you go to high school in Virginia too?
Yeah. Vienna, Virginia, James Madison High School.
No,
and of course, in those days, nobody knew who James Madison was, and now because of Lin-Manuel Miranda, everybody knows.
Yeah, right. Yeah, did you see Hamilton in the theater?
I've seen it 4 times in a theater, and twice on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I have to say, we didn't get a chance to see it in the theater, but I was so stoked when I saw that it was going to be on Disney Plus, and it was kind of the perfect timing too, right around the 4th of July, and.
Right.
It was, well, we're all sort of in this bizarre state of lockdown all across the country.
Yeah.
So, and then did you go to university?
Yeah. So I decided to major in theater, which I, you know, ever since I was, can remember, I don't even remember a time when I wasn't interested in performing or anything.
Were you a theater kid in high school too? Did you do plays?
Yeah. I was total drama geek.
Right on.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. And, you know, like I played when I was 16 years old, I played one of the aunts in Arsenic and Old Lace, you know, that's acting.
Wow. Was that, do you remember, was that like one of the first roles that you really remember doing?
It was certainly the first big role that I got. You know, I got the lead, the co-lead in the school play. It was like, ooh. But I was hesitant to major in it in college. So I went off to a small college in West Virginia for a year, just to kind of get a liberal arts footing and not spend too much of my dad's money, not knowing what I was doing. Sure. And then I ended up deciding that, no, I had theater was in me. I just had to do it. So I went up to Boston, but I didn't go to one of the big like theater colleges. I went to Northeastern University, which had a small, very small drama department, but a co-op program. But what I didn't, and you know, today, like these kids, like they research these colleges to death and they apply to 50 of them. And it's amazing the work that goes into choosing a college now. Whereas I just went, yeah, that looks good. So I got up to Boston and realized, well, the co-op program didn't really apply to theater people because they didn't have theater jobs to send the kids out to do. So I ended up just going straight through through the last 3 years. But what was great about it was that it was this little tiny department. And so I could just do a whole bunch of stuff. Like I got cast in everything. I had a resume when I left college that was crazy. Whereas if I had gone to one of the bigger theater schools, I'm sure I would have struggled and, you know, maybe gotten the second girl from the left and, you know, second bride from the left and, you know, what's that, paint your wagon or something.
Right.
So, so that was great. And so I had a really good experience there. And now today, Northeastern is a big deal, and their theater department is a big deal, and I'm currently actually involved with them as a donor and as a contributor to the department. So I kind of get to give back a little to it, and I get a little, you know, I get a little from that as well. So so then I realized I was about 22, and I had this epiphanal moment where I got recognized one night after a show I had done, and I had played this medieval character who was this ingenue with the conical hat. I look like the blue fairy, you know, from Pinocchio. And somebody actually said that. So I ran into these people in the elevator at like, you know, 3 a.m, and we'd all been drinking. And this guy says, "Oh my God, it's the blue fairy." And I said, "Do you want me to turn you into a real boy?" But you know, so I deflected that moment. And then I got out of the elevator and I completely flipped out. And I went, "Oh, I hated that. I absolutely hate." And you might not believe this of me, but I hated that. I liked being on stage and I liked performing and I liked creating a character and inhabiting that character. But I didn't want to discuss that with people in the outside world afterwards. And I didn't like the sense that they knew me. You know, I mean, this guy was like very familiar.
Yeah. People,
and I've seen it since, obviously, with my career. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of movie stars get approached by people. And it's just, there's this weird familiarity that they haven't earned, you know? So I thought, well, do I want to be the 50-year-old actress struggling in New York as a waitress? You know, do I want, what I would have loved to have had was that career where you're just a working actor and people don't know who you are, but you work all the time.
Yeah.
But in those days, I weighed 110 pounds and I had blonde hair down to my ass and big blue eyes. And I wasn't going to be anything but an ingenue for 40 years, you know, so I thought, I decided to bail on that. And I ended up going to film school. So I came out to California.
So after Northeastern, did you was it grad school? Like a graduate degree?
But I I did the usual, like I waitressed, I was a nanny. I was a Teamster. Mm-hmm. Actually, I drove film processing around. And then
California, you said?
Yeah. So I was involved. I got cast in Boston. I got cast in a movie. It was a Boston University film students thesis project. Mm-hmm. And I got really interested in the behind the scenes part of it. So I started looking into film schools. And eventually after about three years after I graduated with a BA in theater, I got into Stanford. I got into their documentary program. And so I came out to California and I did that. And I got connected with people in the Bay Area. I got interested in narrative filmmaking, and then I ended up at ILM through a series of unfortunate events.
Well, no, that sounds like that's skipping over a lot of stuff, though. Like, so film school, you were studying documentary, but you got interested in narrative. Did you make documentary films when you first came to Stanford?
Yeah, so they had a really sweet deal. They had, it was a documentary program, mm-hmm. and it was film production. And it was 1 year of coursework. And then you went off and you made your thesis film. So I figured, and they gave me a full tuition scholarship. So that cinched the deal. Because I was paying, my dad paid for my undergrad, but if I was going to go to grad school, I was going to pay for it. So I was like, yeah, sign me up for that. So I only had to borrow enough money to live on for a year. Mm-hmm. And of course that ran out in April. So I ended up getting a job.
Well, and probably then too, as a film student, you probably were shooting 16mm, I would guess.
Yeah.
And that's like
old Bell and Howell.
Yeah. Crazy expensive shooting on film. I mean, I look at a lot of students today who are, you know, shooting stuff digitally or even shooting stuff on mobile phones. And I just think, man, what I wouldn't give to have that kind of freedom,
right?
You know? Yeah, for sure.
Right. And it's very egalitarian because you don't have to be rich to go to film school now or to make films, you know, everybody can make films. So it's democratized that a lot. And of course the medium weeds out the wheat from the chaff anyway, mm-hmm. you know, it's so, you know, good on everybody. So yeah, we were shooting with those old World War II Bell and Howells, you know, black and white.
Yeah, they were built like a tank, you know, like really heavy.
They were amazing. Yeah, bulletproof. They were amazing. But you know, they didn't shoot sound. You had to shoot you know, there was no sync sound. You had to, so we did all that. You know, we had the Nagras and the, you know, as a matter of fact, one of my jobs before I came to ILM was I was an assistant editor and in documentaries, and you know, these guys would run and gun. And one of the things that I am really good at is syncing lips, you know, syncing up dailies. Mm-hmm. I say to Dave, that guy's two frames out. What, you know, why it's video. Why is it two frames out?
Right.
It's like, I don't know. What are you talking about? So, yeah. So then I ended up doing some feature work. A woman named Kathy Witt. Now she's Kathy Couturier. I made nice with her, and she ended up at ILM doing Witches of Eastwick, I think. And
so what year was that? Was that like 1980?
It was 87. I had my first interview with ILM in 86.
Okay.
And I didn't get hired. It was classic. You know, I went through like three different interviews with six people in the room, and it all came down to Dennis Muren going, eh.
Do you know what they were working on at that time? Like, what were you interviewing for? A position doing?
Yeah, I was interviewing for as the coordinator on. I knew it a minute ago. Anyway, Ned got it. Ned was working in the purchasing department.
Yep.
He was reporting to Paula Karsh, and he wanted to move up in the world. And you know, it was classic and deserved. You know, he had an inside track.
Sure.
And I think that was, it came down to the person that they knew versus the person that
were you, when you had that opportunity to at least interview for a position there, was that something as an entity, as a company, through your colleague, was that something that was it on your radar? Did you know kind of what they were doing up there and what that was about, or what was your?
Yeah. I mean, I knew what it was. I'd certainly read all the magazine articles. Mm-hmm. And I knew, and I had worked a little bit with animation. I had worked on some, they were science films. It was middle days of Silicon Valley. And a friend of mine was doing films that were funded by like Intel and, you know, various companies. And it would explain the process of silicon, mm-hmm. how silicon was made. So I was helping her do everything, I guess, produce and edit and all that stuff. So we were using animation at the time, and she actually built a model of Silicon Valley out of circuit boards. It was astonishing. And she had Jerry Jeffers from ILM as her advisor. So I had a little bit of background in that, and I understood, you know, what they did at ILM. And basically, I just wanted steady work. I was doing this assistant editing gig, and I was 2 weeks away. Well, actually, the first time I interviewed, I was interviewing with a lot of different people. Bill Couturier was one of them. And I didn't get any of those jobs, mm-hmm. But I did end up getting the assistant editing job. And then about 2 weeks before that came to an end, Chrissy England remembered me from the time that I interviewed for the movie will come to me, I swear it. And so she invited me to come up and interview to be a production assistant on Willow. And I was like, yeah, you know, because the first time they interviewed me was to coordinate. And certainly I didn't think I could afford to live in Marin County on a production assistant's mm-hmm. Pay. But, you know, you never say no to a good interview. So I hauled my butt back up to Marin. I was living in Redwood City at the time. And I had a couple, and that was where I met Patty Blau. That was the first time I met Patty Blau. And she told me that Chrissy was on vacation, even though she had gotten me the interview. So it was Janet Healy was kind of leading the charge. And Patty told me she walked out of that interview and she said to Janet, hire her. So they offered me a job, and I took it just because I thought, well, it's a bird in the hand, and they, you know, they've got benefits. At least I could go to the doctor if I needed to.
Yeah.
And I figured I'd do it for a couple of years and maybe move to LA and work in movies in Los Angeles. And that was sort of what I had in mind. That didn't work out.
So you came in and you started as a production assistant. Was it Willow was the show, or was it a...
It was. They hired me for Willow, but when I got there in June of 1987, McAllister was still in New Zealand shooting plates for Willow. So they didn't really have that much going on in-house. It was just logging, you know, plate sheets. Mm-hmm. And so Patty and Dave Carson were working on Star Trek Next Generation, the pilot, the Farpoint pilot.
Oh, okay.
So they assigned me to those guys. So I was their PA. So, my first day of work, I reported to Patty and Dave, and, you know, one became one of my closest friends of all time and the other I married.
So Patty was Patty producing that one or coordinating that show?
Yeah. So she was producing and Dave was the supervisor. Yep. And they needed a grunt, you know, they just needed a little grunt, like, and I was the perfect little grunt. So I transitioned onto Willow during the course of working on Star Trek that summer. And then what happened on Willow was things got heated up really fast. And so they bumped me into a coordinator position almost right away. I went to work with Phil Tippett on the Ebersysk sequence.
So yeah, not to get too geeky and technical, but like we've kind of already transitioned into that territory a little bit here. But like, I'm so curious, like, so a show like that, so whether it was the Star Trek pilot or Willow, like... That seems like that's right on the cusp of things still being largely optical, still, of course, being shot on film.
It was all optical.
But there were a few things that were starting to happen that were digital in terms of the morphing sequence in Willow, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the introduction sequence of the slit scan thing that John Knoll developed for the pilot for Star Trek.
But that was still done on a down shooter, if I'm not mistaken. The first slit scan was done on a down shooter. But I will tell you this. So before I got to ILM, so I think 1985 was Young Sherlock, if I'm not mistaken. You can look it up. I can just IMDb right now. So the very first computer graphic animation was that ILM worked on and composited into a shot was on... Young Sherlock.
Yeah.
And it was the stained glass man, right? And Dave Carson was the art director on that. So he was very much interested in where that was all going to go. But when I got there that summer, everything was being composited, even the stained glass man. So what they would do is they would produce the element on a computer. They would film it out. Mm-hmm. And then composite, then it would go to optical, that negative would go to optical and they do the composite. So I guess it was an inner positive.
So for you coming in, like as somebody who had been really interested in theater, but then had started working, mm-hmm. some doing work in, you know, documentary film, maybe transitioning into narrative, coming into this world where it's really heavy effects, heavy post, mm-hmm. very, mm-hmm. very technical. Was this something that, did it come naturally to you, or was it something that took you a while to kind of wrap your head around? Like, what was that like as a transition coming from sort of the background that you had, which is maybe a more, I don't know, it just seems like a more kind of humanistic background as opposed to this real technical kind of, or was that something, did you have that kind of in you already, do you think?
What I have in me is a production sense, you know, so I have two sides to me. I can be extremely creative, which I've been able to do, you know, I've been able to get back to that in the last 10 or so years, 20 years. But in those days, what I was getting paid to do was not creative. It was, you need to organize these people, tie their shoes, make sure their noses are wiped, and then it's all get turned in.
Yeah, keep the machine going.
Yeah. I have a natural ability for that. I once did a production seminar where I asked the people, raise your hand if you were the information conduit for your dysfunctional family. And, you know, like 80% of the hands went up.
Sure.
And the only reason 20% didn't go was because they didn't really understand the question. But if you're going to do production, that is what you have a skill set. Your skill set is like getting people to communicate with each other, mm-hmm. and understanding. You don't have to do what they do. You don't have to be an expert in what they do, but you have to understand it well enough to get people to talk to each other who can speak the same language.
Do you think the background in performing arts, the background in theater, like was that helpful in that kind of, like the concept I hear a lot of like actors talk about, like you know, that a big part of being good at performing is listening and knowing kind of what's happening, what's being said, really hearing what someone is saying, how they're communicating. Mm-hmm. Just what you're describing seems like maybe, do you feel like there's some connective tissue there?
Maybe. Joe Martin once said to me, you know, you're just a wonderful producer. And I said, it's funny because I hate it. And he said, but you do it so well and you look like you're having such a good time. And I said, well, then you're telling me that I'm a wonderful actress and I appreciate that. So I think I used, you know, I used my acting talent to play the role of this person that I had actually no interest in being. You know, the people that I worked with had come to ILM because they had seen the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad when they were 14 years old, and there was nothing else they could ever imagine doing, you know. Or in later years, they came because they had seen Star Wars when they were seven, and that's what they wanted to do. I didn't wake up one day when I was 12 and go, I want to be a visual effects producer, because A, the job didn't even exist when I was 12 years old. But two, it just wasn't like, it just wasn't on my radar. But I really liked what I discovered as a result of being at ILM, was that I liked the people. And I liked, I was really interested in some of the work, not all of it. You know, after a while, it got a little tedious. Like, how many spaceships do you watch blow up? But there was some really amazing work that got done, you know, quietly and behind the scenes. And to me, like, the best effects were always the ones that integrated so beautifully into the story that you weren't even thinking about the fact that they were effects.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the feather in Forrest Gump. You know, the people who watch the beginning of that movie don't sit there and analyze that and go, oh, well, that's a really interesting motion control show. You know, they're just going, wow, that's so lyrical and beautiful. And you know, that's to me is what makes effects art. And I mean, it's all art, but that's really what elevates it into the realm of the Louvre, you know, kind of art.
Yeah.
And I like being around artists a lot. I really do.
So you worked with Patty and Dave on Willow, is that correct?
Well, Star Trek.
And then you moved on to Willow.
Yeah, and actually Patty was one of the coordinators on Willow, and Dave was the art director, the visual effects art director. So we just all stayed in that bullpen room and transitioned onto Willow.
And what came after that? Did you continue, were you continuously employed there? Did you leave for a while or?
Yeah, I was. It was amazing. I would occasionally take breaks. You know, I would take a month off or something just because of the burnout factor. But I never, I think they laid me off technically, you know, just so I could collect unemployment when I would take like a 2 month break. Mm-hmm. But I was always, there was always work.
Yeah.
They always had something that they could throw at me.
Yeah.
Until one day they didn't. No, that's not fair. That's not fair. I had gone into animation development and with Patty, and that didn't work out. And so I was laid off, and to my dear friend's credit, both Chrissy England and Gail Curry called me, and each one offered me something that she was able to offer, but I couldn't really take them up on it.
So this is many years later, right?
My mother was clearly had Alzheimer's. And, yeah. That was in 2001.
Yeah.
So even though I could have gone back to ILM, I didn't, because I had to deal with aging parents and diseases and whatnot. But you know, actually the truth is I didn't ever really want to be a 50-year-old, like, just like I didn't want to be the 50-year-old waitress in New York, mm-hmm. hoping to be an actor. I didn't really want to be a 50-year-old visual effects producer because at the end of the day, that job at ILM was really just being a glorified production assistant. I just got paid a lot more money as a producer than I did as a production assistant, but it kind of amounted to the same thing. Because it really wasn't producing in that way that, like, you think of Kathleen Kennedy as a producer, right? So Kathleen Kennedy is the queen of the universe, right? At ILM, that no producer is ever the queen of the universe or the king. You know, you're just you're in the middle. You've got ILM management that you report to. You've got these crews that you're trying to manage that aren't even the people that you would have gone out and picked necessarily. You know, like, as a producer, you hire the people you want to hire. At ILM, you had to go to a manager and go, can I have Matt on my show? You know, and they go, no, we need Matt over here, you know. know.
So
in
that's,
the real world, I would say, "Hey, Matt, come over and work for me because I'll pay you better and I'll be nicer to you." And but it wasn't like that. Because it was all staff, right?
So everybody was staff for the most part, and so. I never saw that side of it. So that's kind of how it worked was they would set it up where a show would come in, you'd bid on a show and so the management team would pick who's going to produce. You would get coordinators, production assistants and supervisor. Yeah. And then you'd just staff up based on who was available or.
So you'd have to go to the Ken Mariamas and the Paul Griffins and say, okay, this is how I need 10 compositors and I need five TDs and I need, you know, whatever it is you knew you were going to need to get these shots done. And they'd go to their little board and tell you who was available. And you'd go, well, what if, you know, I worked with Larry on the last show and he was awesome. Like I would really love to have him on the show because of his skill set and, you know, and Janice over here, she does these amazing like rotos and they're like, yeah, no, you can't do that. You can't have those people, but you can have these people, you know, like,
I mean, that's pretty interesting. I mean, and just thinking back of, at least historically, my understanding would be like around the time that you started, like total employees, maybe a couple hundred people.
Oh no. The summer I started, there were 80 people on payroll. So then what happened was Willow came in and Roger Rabbit ramped up. So by 6 months hence, there were 350 people on payroll. That was it. That was ILM was bulked out at 350 people.
Wow. And so do you recall at that time too, was that prior to the sale of Pixar or had that already
been
placed?
I think that's true. I'm pretty sure Pixar wasn't sold until after that because they were, when I got there, Pixar, you know, that group was, still in C building.
Right.
And they were doing Wally B maybe. I mean, there was something or Jerry's Game. I can't remember. They were doing something over there. That seemed really cool. You know, but George of course didn't have any interest in that.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, so he sold it to Steve Jobs and you know, the rest of the story.
So, and you, where did you go after Willow? Do you remember what your next show was? And like, when did you go from being coordinator to starting to do like producing? Was it fairly quick?
Oh, I never wanted to be a producer. I loved being a coordinator. You didn't have the responsibility that the producers had. You didn't have to talk about money with people all day long. You got to go around the building all day and chat with your pals about what they were up to and keep track of shit. It was awesome. I loved it. And I did it on Back to the Future 2 and 3. Actually, there's a job that's called a plate coordinator, right? Well, when I first got there, there was no such thing as a plate coordinator. The producer, like I remember on Indy 3, Patty went to Spain. She was the producer. She went to Spain with whoever it was, maybe Mike McAllister. And she, you know, she's the one doing all that stuff. Well, they realized, well, you can't be in two places at once, especially if you're overseas. So we need somebody to go to the location and just keep track of all that stuff. That's the producer needs to be doing other things. So I got picked to do that job on Back to the Future too. And the work grew to the extent that I couldn't coordinate the show at ILM and be in LA or wherever that, you know, we were, Sonora on 3. And so then they brought in other coordinators, Annie Calanchini and Jennifer Knoll, I think was part of that team. And so they were coordinating all the material back at ILM and keeping track of the model shop and all that stuff. And, you know, I was off in LA and then later in Sonora with the first unit and sometimes second unit. So that became known as plate coordinating. So I guess you could say I invented that job. I didn't invent it, but I might have been the first person who actually held that title.
Yeah, I mean, as more and more shots probably got added to shows, they felt like there was a fatter pipe that they could push more content through. They needed they needed more people and people who kind of understood the process to sort of manage all the data that was coming back from set and whatever else, I assume.
Well, and they would compress the schedule. See, that, so let's take Indy 3 as an example, or Willow. Willow is a perfect example where they'd shoot the whole movie and then they'd do the post, which included the effects. But it got to the point where they kept cramming the schedule. They're making them shorter and shorter, so that you had to be shooting the movie at the same time you're posting the movie. And you know, this has happened with visual effects supervisors too. You probably watched this happen, where they put two guys on a show, and I use the word guys intentionally. They put two guys on a show, and so one would be off shooting plates, and the other one would be at ILM starting to ramp up these crews and supervising the shots that were beginning to come out of the pipeline. And it wasn't us. That wasn't our decision. It was driven by the business, just cramming, you know, just shorter and shorter time periods.
Yeah. That's it.
Oh yeah. So then I did Back to the Futures 2 and 3. What else did I do? I did Hook.
Now on Hook, did you produce Hook, or were you still doing coordinating play?
No, Hook was a very difficult experience that we probably shouldn't talk about in public. But I will tell you this. It's what made me decide to be a producer. It was the management of that show was lacking. Let's just say it was. Here's how I'll say it. If it were happening to me today, I would sue them for a hostile work environment.
Oh, okay.
I'll just say it like that. So what ended up, I was coordinating the map paintings on Hook, which was, you know, the map department, right? It's a full-time job. So it was just such a horrific experience for so many reasons that I realized that if you're in charge of the crew, you at least get to set the tone. And that was, so when the next time somebody came to me and said, so you want to produce? I said, yeah, I'll do that. But I won't coordinate. Or if I coordinate, I get to say who I work with. And they don't, you know, coordinators don't get to do that. So it was.
I was just going to say, it's really interesting to hear you describe it that way, because, you know, through sort of an adverse experience, you come through the other side and decide that you want to have more say in how a show is run. My experience of working with you over the years, you were a producer that I had the good fortune of working with on multiple shows at ILM. You were without question my favorite producer to work with, which is why I wanted to talk to you first. Because I really do feel like that was one of the things when I look back on my time there, not to be too nostalgic, but when I look back on my time there, I think back on the most fun I had working were when I was working on shows, which maybe weren't the coolest shows to work on, but I had the greatest time because I was working with you, with your team, with I think it was Stefan Fangmeier for a while, I think was the supervisor. Yeah. And while I felt like we always took the work seriously, I always felt like nobody who was my superior, they were never taking themselves so seriously, where they were making the people who were maybe the subordinates. I never felt bad. I always felt like we were all in it together. We were all kind of, you know, moving the ball down the field towards the goal line, and we were having fun doing it. And so when I look back on my time there, I think of those shows in particular, whether it was Speed 2 or Twister, you know, like these kind of corny projects. Those were really fun. I mean, the technology and stuff, some of the things we were doing were interesting, but moreover, it was just the people, like, and I think you had said that before too. And I feel like your production office, you always set a tone, maybe after some of these experiences that you had, you set a tone that was a very positive, very egalitarian, and there was a levity and a kind of, just sort of a joy. It was fun to come to work, even when you had to come in on a Saturday.
Because life's too short, right? Like, what is the point of not having fun? They used to joke at ILM, like, we came here to have fun and make money.
Said to me at one point something that I've always remembered, which was, you know, if you're not having fun, while you're making movies, you're probably doing it wrong. I thought that was pretty good. You know?
Well, and I think that spirit gets infused into the material as well. So whatever it is, it's like cooking. You know, my aunt was referring to an aunt that she had had, and she said there was no love in her cooking. And I think that sort of attitude, you know, that love or whatever, fun, what joy, whatever you want to call it, it does get infused in whatever it is you touch and whatever it is you do.
Yeah.
And it matters.
Yeah.
I believe that. So anyway, but mostly I just don't like to have a bad time. It's just not.
Oh, yeah. Why bother?
We were there. And especially on a show where you're up against it and you're working 70, 80 hours a week, like, who wants to be miserable for 80 hours a week? If I wanted to do that, I'd rob a bank and go to prison.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, I'm glad you had a good time. It was fun. We did work on some really stupid movies. It's so funny because there's a couple of films on my resume that I'm proud of, but I have a lot of really shitty films on my resume.
Yeah. I think most people, today it seems like there's so much more content being produced now than was happening, even back then. You know, you were saying there were 80 people when you started at ILM. I think there were about 250 people or so when I started in 1992. And when I left in late 1999, almost right before 2000, there were over 1,500, I think, if memory serves.
Yeah, so that sounds right.
It exploded, in terms of the scale. And I don't know how many people work now at that fancy new superstore they've built in the city, but it seems like it's got to be bigger.
Yeah, I think so. I haven't been there in a while. I would occasionally go and have lunch with somebody there, and it's a lot like my elevator experience. When I go to ILM, I can't walk 20 feet without somebody going, "Oh my God!" You know, and so it's really annoying to the person that I'm with because it's hard to have a conversation. So I usually, if I'm going to meet somebody for lunch, I meet them off campus. But it is, it is fun to see it, but it's not a place I necessarily wish I could work in.
No, yeah, not now that it's part of the Magic Kingdom.
I guess so, but they all get passes to Disneyland, which is super cool. Although they can't use them now, but
that's true.
Oh well.
So let's see. I have to say I haven't actually ever looked at your credits list, but let's see. We've got Willow, Back to the Futures 2 and 3, Hudson Hawk, Hook, The Nutcracker, Disclosure. I think that's around the time. Yeah, that's about when I was there, I think.
In the Mouth you showed of
Madness,
up, yeah.
Twister and Speed 2, and Small Soldiers. I think that's the trifecta that I worked on with you. Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
Creamester 2. Sure, yeah. Oh, that's an interesting show to have on your list there. And
I love seeing that on my IMDb. It cracks me up. I love it.
And then was Galaxy Quest, was that your last show there?
That was my swan song, yeah.
That's a good one to end on. That's kind of a fun one.
I felt it was ending on a high note. I actually did an interview with a guy who's writing a book about Galaxy Quest just the other day. I guess it's been 20 years, 20 plus years.
Wow. That's so disturbing.
But yeah, I love Galaxy. It was the funniest script I ever read. Just hilarious. It was so good that I said, even DreamWorks can't screw this up. It's bulletproof. And there were times during the course of making the film that I thought, oh, they are screwing it up, but they never, they couldn't. It was bulletproof.
good on them. After you left was that 2000 and?
I left in 2001.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I left in 99. And then, so after you left, what did you do after? Did you take some time off?
I did. Yeah. I've always loved animals, and I had been volunteering at my local shelter since 1993, I think. I would go in on Sunday. The Sundays that I was in town, I'd go in and walk the shelter dogs because I couldn't have a dog with that kind of work schedule.
Sorry, is that the San Rafael Animal Shelter?
It's a Marin Humane.
Oh, okay.
It used to be called the Marin Humane Society, and they shortened it to, they rebranded. They're now Marin Humane. So, yeah, so I would go over there on Sundays and walk dogs and get my dog fix. And we had a cat, you know, so I, when I left ILM and I had all this time, Dave and I were both laid off on the same day. I knew I was going to get laid off, but we did not see that coming with him. We were like deer in headlights. We're like, what the fuck? But he very quickly got an offer from Electronic Arts. They were doing the James Bond games and they wanted him to come down and bring some of his movie expertise to the visuals. So that was awesome. So they offered him pretty much what he'd been making at ILM, but with better stock options and slightly better benefits. So he said to me, why don't you take some time and, you know, pursue all these things that you're interested in? And one of the things I learned was that I can do anything I want. I just can't do everything I want. So I looked into becoming a dog behaviorist. I looked into training. I did all kinds of things. But in the end, I just ended up as a volunteer because I love working with the dogs and the cats. And I used to work with rabbits too, but I didn't like working with the people because here's what I learned. This is the joy of ILM. I just thought the world was like ILM. You know, I got to ILM when I was 30 years old and I was there for 14 years and I worked with some of the most amazingly intelligent, warm, human, lovely people. And you get out in the world and you find out the world isn't really, that's not the general makeup of the population. Yeah. And I don't mean to sound condescending or snotty, but I was used to being around people who were super sharp, constant, yep. You know, just always on it.
I have the same problem.
It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. And so I didn't really want to deal with the general public. I've worked in behavior and training now for 26 years and I evaluate dog behavior. So that's easy. I can do that. The only dog I could never figure out was our dog Daisy. Of course, it was my dog, the one I couldn't figure out. But so I did that. And then in 2002, I started looking into the local theater scene, community theater, and I got very involved in that. And so that has taken up a tremendous amount of my efforts over the last 20 years.
Yeah, didn't you wind up too, like you were directing some plays too, if memory serves?
You know, what's funny is like, so at ILM, so you know, the thing with producers, right? People go, they roll their eyes, oh, the producer, you know, it's that bitch that wants to talk to me about my salary, you know, or, you know, things are taking too long or they're too expensive or whatever. But people, so I wasn't really thought of as a person with a creative core. So it's really great now. People I used to work with come to see plays I directed and they're like, that was awesome. Like you are. And I'm like, yeah, thank you. Or they'll come see me on stage, you know, and they'll go, oh my God, I didn't know that was you. Which is wonderful. I love that. I love sharing with my old stalwart community. And people have been super gracious about supporting the local theater. So yeah, so I direct, I act. I've done some producing. I've done some of my own producing. It's different when you do it for yourself. It still sucks. I still don't like it, but at least I have this really big investment. And what else? There's something. Oh, props. I'm actually a decent costume designer. I can't sew, but I know what works. And props. I became like a prop person. So I became like my own little model maker in late in life. It was kind of fun. I've made some.
Are there things that
15 years or so?
Right on. Are there things that you feel like, in terms of your work in doing stuff with theater, or you mentioned you're doing some writing and stuff now. Do you feel like there are aspects of some of that more creative work that, I mean, this is a hard one to answer. It's kind of a hard question to formulate, but I'm sort of thinking, is there a way in which the 14 years at ILM, like, is there a way in which like that structure, working with those people, that kind of creative problem solving that would go on, like, do you feel like that informs how you approach other creative endeavors that you're doing now?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it does. I learned so much. And the interesting thing about directing, you know, I went to, I have a drama degree, but I never thought of myself as a director. And I wasn't sure I knew how to direct a play. I learned how to direct movies in film school, but I was like, oh yeah, I get this, because you know, you have to focus on what the director is telling you to focus on, right? That's your point of focus, is whatever that shot is. And on stage, I wasn't sure how to get like an entire 30-foot stage. I wasn't sure how to get you to like look over here, or, you know, this is what we need to do. And this is so weird. Like I was, I don't know, 43 or something. And I woke up one morning and I went, oh my God, I know how to do this. And we were at ILM, we formed a little lunchtime group. It was all the theater geeks got together and we put on plays at lunchtime. And I started directing. That was where I started directing. And I loved it. And I was like, oh my God, I know how to do this. So when I started directing a community theater, I was just, and I, all the stuff that I learned watching people make movies, you know, for 30 years, like it all just came, it all just coalesced somehow in my, I was like, it was like batch processing. It was like, all the data had come in and then one day, you know, it got rendered and spit out. And there I was, I was like, oh, I know how to do this. And I actually, this sounds horrible. I'm really good at it. Like that, if you ask people in Northern Marin or in Marin, like, you know, who are the top five musical theater directors, and they'll tell you I'm one of them. I was like, I know how to direct it. I don't even sing that well. Like, how do I know how to direct a musical? But I get it. You know, I understand the dynamics of it. Again, you know, people, actors tell me, like, I auditioned for the show because I wanted to work with you. And whatever it was that you related to, I bring that, you know, to the theater. So point in spending 3 hours of your evening, your free time, your volunteer time, and getting yelled at. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? So
that's so super cool. Yelling. That's so great.
There's no yelling. Yeah.
And are you working on anything right now?
Well, I was.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess that's
true.
And
I got shut down.
It's hard to work on anything right now. That's a good point.
For a split second,
I forgot.
I know. Yeah, I was doing, this is so funny. I was doing Godspell and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat concurrently. Godspell was supposed to be a concert to raise money for our local street chaplaincy, which serves dinners to the homeless population. And it would have been the third one that we did. So we did Jesus Christ Superstar. We did Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And then we were going to do Godspell. And, you know, one day we just said, okay, we can't do it. And then I was also directing Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat again, but for a different theater company that is a family theater company. So I had like, you know, 8-year-old kids and 75-year-old people. So that was kind of fun. We were working on that. And it just, you know, we just had to shut the doors and say, you know, hopefully we'll do it later.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely like for anything like that, so much of what makes certainly theater fun, but really any kind of jobs, going teaching at a university, being in a classroom, like so much of like just human interaction, being robbed of that now for so long is really difficult, to say the least. It's definitely a drag. Well, Kim, I see we're approaching about an hour here and I'm taking up a lot of your time.
It's lovely to see you.
I know, it's lovely to see you too. Part of the idea behind this is purely self-interest. Like, there's so many old friends and colleagues that I haven't really talked to in a long time, other than just like, you know, a quick glance on some social media thing or something. And so it's really nice to be able to connect. And I realized too, even just, you know, tonight talking with you, there's so many things about your personal story, like your sort of your personal journey, things that I wasn't aware of. Like I knew you were from Vienna, Virginia, but I didn't know that you'd studied theater. I didn't know you went to Stanford and studied film. Like, so that's really great. So it's really fun. I can't thank you enough for being willing to be the guinea pig in the first of what I hope will be many chats of similar quality.
Well, I was so flattered that you, I was like, you really want to start with me, but
you were the first name that I thought of, the very first person.
That's really sweet. Thank you. Thank you. And Dave said he'd be happy to talk to you. If he's way more interesting cool. than I. Well, he's got a much better resume, and he's very funny. So there's that.
Yeah, I got to go.
He did see Seventh Voyage of Sinbad when he was 14, and he is that person who, you know, so he.
I got this really cool thing that happened last year. I got a call from, I do another show, like a, where it's like a review show on visual effects movies and stuff with a couple guys from, a guy from Australia and a guy from New York. And we've been doing that for years now. And I got a call from a guy who worked at Amazon and he was helping set up the Amazon Mars conference that happens in Palm Springs. And so he called me and asked me if he said he liked my commentary on the VFX show that we did, because he usually agreed with me and not my two co-hosts about the things that I thought sucked in a movie or the effects that didn't work or did work or whatever. And he invited me to come and serve as a moderator for an evening talk that we did at the Palm Springs airport. And it was me on stage talking to Dennis and John Knoll, which was hilarious.
I saw photos of that. Yeah. Yeah.
and then they had Mark Hamill come on and I got to sit and interview him, which I didn't really have to do anything. It's like you wind him up and he just kind of goes. And I think I asked him like two or three questions and he just, you know, performed for the crowd. But it was super fun. It was really cool. And I started thinking about it and I had a great time that week. It was like 5 days and I actually got to hang out, which I never did when we worked at ILM, but I got to hang out a little bit with Dennis and a little bit with John. And like, yeah. I think, I don't know if they remembered me or I couldn't really tell, but it was one of those things where like, by the end of it, I thought, well, I could probably do something like that. There's a lot of stories. There's so many stories that get told about like all the technical achievements at ILM. But the thing that nobody ever talks about, which is the thing that you mentioned, which is the thing that I feel like is the most profound part of it, is the people that you worked with. Like you said it yourself, like you spent 14 years working with all these incredibly, amazingly creative, like totally like on the ball people. You'd have a meeting in the morning after dailies about a problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd discuss it. A team would be dispatched and by lunchtime or shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. the problem would be solved or be on its way to being solved. And that isn't normal. Like I thought that was normal too. That was my first job out of college, was working there for, you know, almost 10 years. And like, I look back on that and I just think like, wow, like I didn't appreciate it at the time because I was so young and kind of a punk kid. But I look back on that and I think, wow, that was a really unique place and a unique corporate culture too, in terms of the kind of personality that was drawn to that, but then also the way in which there were egos, there were issues, there were problems, there were some difficult times for sure for everybody. But I think too, there was this kind of focus on solving really complex problems, creative problem solving. And I feel like that's something that isn't talked about enough, you know?
You mentioned the morph in Willow, and that's something that if you do talk to Dave Carson, he can speak, but he was there. One time Doug Kay said to me, you know, Dave Carson invented morphing. And I said, how is that possible? And I asked him about it and he said, well, I didn't invent it. He said there were about five or six of us that were trying to solve this problem. And I suggested X, Y, and Z. And that's, you know, but so I often joke because people use it's a verb now. But I mean, people just use the word morph, right? Sure. And I sometimes laugh and I go, yeah, my husband invented that. Which isn't true, but he was part, it was what you just described, where they said, okay, how are we going to do this? And Dave, you know, Dave was really interested in using computers to do this work. And he said, well, what if you did it in a 2D way? What if you did like attach points in 2D? And that's, you know, and then of course all the great minds started throwing that around. But I think conceptually he was a big part of that. And they went off and did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so many other things. I mean, and I just think that's the thing that I look back on with the, other than, you know, the people, but that culture of that creative problem solving, teamwork, the willingness to try stuff, to like make mistakes, to learn from your mistakes, and to sort of like, all right, well, that didn't work. Like, let's try this instead. Maybe this will work better. And I feel like that's something that there's so many really profound and powerfully good lessons, I think, that can be learned from that cultural mindset. I always wondered if that was something culturally, if that was something like, where did that come from? Did it come from the top, you know, was that something that, or was it something in the nature of that type of work?
I think it might be in the nature of the work. Although, you know, George, I like to be realistic about George, but George is, when you want to talk about George's strengths, you know, he's very creative, and part of what annoyed us about him was that he never wanted to spend any money on anything, but he was the richest guy we all knew. But at the same time, that's what makes you creative. Right? The constraint, like anybody can do anything if they have enough money and time. The constraints are, what do you do? You don't have enough time. There's never enough time. And what do you do if you only have two sticks instead of five sticks? Like, how are you going to make it work? And I think it comes with the territory that you're forced into creative solutions because of your constraint.
So I totally agree. Like, I mean, that's totally well said. Like, yeah, how do you make it look like $1 million when you only have like, you know, $500, right?
Yeah.
Like the creative problem solving. And we were joking around, I think you and I, on the email about what does ILM stand for? Now, I've heard, there are two great ones that I heard on set. One of them was, I love money, which I thought was genius. And the other one, because the visual effects crew was always just sitting around waiting till they had the opportunity to rush in and, like, you know, bust out the chrome ball and the gray sphere and take their photos and take some quick, you know, measurements and triangulate. But the rest of the time we would always just be sort of sitting around. And so they said it could stand for in lounge mode. Now you had I think.
Well, it lacks management came out of hook, but the one that I heard, the very first one, clients would say, I love money, but the inside joke when I got there was, it looks miniature, was the original.
Oh, that's good. I hadn't heard that one. That's perfect.
Can I tell you one quick funny story? I was on the set of Casper. I was on the set of Casper, and you know, it was the first time we did that kind of large scale animation, character animation, and I was filling in for Penny Runge, who was the plate coordinator, and the grips were, I don't know whether they were new, like I don't know who these guys were, the LA crew, but they were complaining about how long everything was taking to set up. And I said to them, they're looking at me because I'm the ILM person, and I said to them, what movie are you working on? And they're like, well, Casper. And I said, do you see him here? And that was, you know, the level of effort that it takes to shoot something that you're then later going to put something into was I think daunting for people. Even in those were even early days. Those were still like middle days. You know, it was post Jurassic Park, but people still found it. Now I think everybody's super hip to it.
Yeah, it's so much more familiar for people now. One of the things I think now that's so interesting, I don't know if you follow any of this stuff, I kind of can't help myself, but sort of still pay attention. Part of it too is just teaching. I kind of feel like I have to kind of keep my eye on what's going on. Yeah, my on the pulse.
Finger on the pulse.
But the so many interesting things happening in the world of virtual production, like using big LED screens to capture 3D environments in camera, also giving actors something to respond to, and I think that kind of real time rendering. The ability to be a real-time ray tracing to create realistic reflections and lit environments, and to have a camera move in the real world, adjust a virtual camera in parallax, you know, that's pretty exciting.
Amazing.
And yeah, the potential that has for really revolutionizing some of the stage visual effects type of work, I think is really interesting.
Have you seen the documentary series about the making of The Mandalorian?
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I loved it. And I said to Dave, what I love about this is watching our friends talk about it and not having to deal with it.
Right.
But it
yeah, we don't have to worry about like,
you know, I don't have to, don't have to, yeah,
worry about things
like when the cameras go down or when the screen breaks or whatever. But sure. But the idea that the actors now have something, because I used to work with actors who were like looking at cross hatches on a blue screen. This was like before green screen, right?
Yeah.
And you know, people say, why do they pay those guys so much? And it's like, because they're fucking amazing. Like they know, I don't know how to do this. I can't do this. I once did the stand-in shot for Michael Fox, the walk and talk in Back to the Future 3, where he and Seamus are walking and talking. So mm-hmm. they set that up on the stage at ILM, and Michael wasn't there yet. And they said, Kim, can you walk through this? And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. You know, I never hit those marks right. Ken just gave up on me. He was just like, fuck it, I'll wait till Michael gets here. They show Michael the move. I'm serious. They show Michael the move. He goes, got it. And he walked and won. He did it in one try. And I was like, okay, I guess that's why you get paid $20 million and I get paid $20,000.
Yeah. So, it'd be really interesting to see.
But they don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of technology, these technological breakthroughs, it does feel like this might be a little hyperbolic, but looking at some of that work in that making of thing you were talking about, it does really look mm-hmm. like and feel like kind of, it feels as profound a change in the modality of work in visual effects as did, you know, I would say Jurassic for photoreal computer graphics, but, you know, maybe even going back to T2 or The Abyss or whatever, or even as far back as the young Sherlock Holmes you were talking about. But it does feel like it's definitely the first really big change since that moment anyway, in terms of the technological.
I agree. I think it's thrilling. And what's great for me now is I'm the audience, you know?
Yeah, me too.
It's great. And I'm happy to play that role.
Yeah. Well, Kim, it's such a real honor to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time to meet up. I'm assuming you weren't super busy, given that we're all locked down. So, yeah. But no, it really means a lot to me to have the chance to talk with you and to hear your story. And I think certainly my students will get a lot out of it too. So thank you.
Well, thank you for asking me. And it was really great to see you. This has just been a lovely hour. Thank you.